Strange Studies of Strange Stories. There was once a shoemaker who, through no fault of his own, had become so poor that he had only enough leather left for a single pair of shoes. That evening, he cut out the shoes, which he planned to work on the next morning, and since he had a clear conscience, he lay down quietly in his bed, commended himself to God, and fell asleep. In the morning, after he had said his prayers and was about to sit down to do his work, he saw the two shoes standing all finished on his workbench. He was so astounded by this that he did not know what to say. He took the shoes in his hand to examine them more closely and saw that the shoes were perfect. Not a single bad stitch could be found, and it was as if the shoes were intended to be masterpieces.
It's that time of the year! Elves are making toys and hiding on shelves, so I figured it's the perfect season for the elves! As collected by the Brothers Grimm.
This is tale 39 from Kinder und Hausmärchen, Children's and Household Tales, and we're going to be discussing these magical elves on Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
But not just elves, other strange magical little people with Rumpelstiltskin. It's a Christmas miracle!
Rumpelstiltskin was one of my favorite fairy tales as a small child, and rereading the story, I realize I have no idea why. That story is pure insanity. Don't know what appealed to me, but I enjoyed it yet again.
Who was that reader?
Why, that was my wife, Heather Klinke, whom I've long suspected of having elvish heritage. Oh, she seemed very excited about reading this one. We released this Christmas ghost story last week as our extra credit episode, The Water Ghost of Harrowby Hall. It's a funny one, and you can hear that in full if you're subscribed at the scholar level. So please consider doing that. Listening to a ghost story for the holidays is an old tradition we'd like to resuscitate.
Yeah.
And that's why we released it a little early. But while choosing a ghost story, I was also considering a piece by Charlotte Perkins Gilman of the Yellow Wallpaper fame.
Yeah.
It's a story called The Giant Wistaria. It's a really cool story, but super sad, as many ghost stories are. A little heavy, I thought, for the holidays. I wanted to find something more humorous than that, so we went with The Water Ghost. Nevertheless, I'm going to get Heather to read that story in full, The Giant Wistaria, and we'll have that coming up in the new year, along with lots of other special stuff. So please look out for that and stick with us in 2024, which will be our 15th year broadcasting this show, some iteration of this show. I think we're finally hitting our stride. We kind of worked out the kinks after 15 years. Anyway, thank you, Heather, for taking this ride with us. And let's just go ahead and get into today's stories.
Our first story, The Elves, was brought to the Brothers Grimm by the Wild family. This was a group of sisters and a brother that related tales that they heard. Like the Hassenflug family, they spoke French and heard a lot of these as French tales.
They would visit the Grimms and tell these stories as we described in our Snow White episode. The Elves, or Die Wichtelmänner, was related by Dorchen Wild. I guess it'd be Wild if you're speaking German, but I like Wild. Dorchen actually would wind up marrying Wilhelm Grimm.
Wow.
They had three children, and because she had been part of this work from the beginning, this story was in the 1812 edition, probably narrated around 1810.
Mm-hmm.
She married Wilhelm in 1825. So by that point, she really understood that he and his brother were all about the scholarly work. They didn't like their distractions. And she looked after domestic affairs for both brothers. Jacob lived with them. Really, this is a Grimm sister who told this tale.
Wow, yeah. The Wilds lived across the street from the Grimms and were middle class, with their protective father running an apothecary shop. Aside from Dorchen, there was Maria Elizabeth, Lisette, and Gretchen.
Lisette and Dorchen are listed as the source for Rumpelstiltskin. And again, I'm pulling this from the Complete Fairy Tales of the Brothers Grimm, translated and annotated by Jack Zeitz. There's three editions of it. Any of them are great.
Yeah.
For having a read of these things.
Gretchen Wild is also an important storyteller. She was 23 years old in 1810, around the time that she related these tales. Mm. She also told them the golden bird, the stolen pennies, and all the sisters participated in telling Hansel and Gretel, which we are covering next week.
I wasn't familiar with these tales about the elves at all.
Yes.
And you referenced Elf on the Shelf. I'm sure we've discussed it before, but I don't even really know how elves wound their way into both the holidays and fiction. Elves are everywhere.
The elf myth comes out of Germanic folklore, Northern Germanic folklore specifically. Mm. They originally were spirits of all different types, but they came to represent small, beautiful creatures. Now, in the Prose Edda, there were light elves and dark elves. I think if you saw Thor Dark World film, you would know that he battled dark elves in that film.
Right.
that some precedent has been set with the second Thor film, that that's exactly how it was. That was totally real.
Uh-huh.
Also, this light elves and dark elves might be connected with the Scottish Seelie and Unseelie courts.
What are those?
In the mythology, there were two types of elves. There was the Seelie and the Unseelie. The Seelie were the more beautiful, kind elves, but they were still tricky and weird. And then the Unseelie were the really malevolent, gross elves. And then they had different seasons. So like the winter would be the time of the year of the Unseelie, and the summer would be the time of year of the Seelie. And lots of myths around that. It's been modernized a lot. They're in White Wolf's Changeling. It's all about that stuff. In the Harry Dresden books, they've got a bunch of that stuff in there.
Because
too.
When you say elves, but they were also fairies, right? It's kind of one and the same. The Scottish Seelie and Unseelie courts were like good and bad fairy
all fairies
organizations.
Yeah, like, you know, the Bloodcaps and, you know, all those other guys there were Unseelie.
Right. So it's sort of the Justice League and then the Legion of Doom.
Exactly.
In the fairy world of Scotland.
Yeah, but the Seelie elves weren't always nice. They would still do tricky things and steal babies.
Well, it's the same with the Justice League. Robin stole a baby. You think Gleek wasn't stealing babies?
Gleek was totally stealing babies. At times, it was believed that elves were the cause of disease, and they were said to sit on your chest while you slept, and that's where you got bad dreams, and that was called Alpdrucken, or elf pressure.
Okay, so cats are elves. Got it. Alpdrucken. Yeah. Oh, sorry, I just had a little Alpdrucken when I woke up this morning.
I've wondered how we have little elves and tall elves in myth. So you've got, you know, your Tolkien elves, which are really tall and pretty and got basically humans with pointy ears. But then you also have your little guys that work for Santa Claus and help make shoes. So in Norse mythology, we have the Dökulfar and the Ljósafár, and those are from the Prose Edda as well. Dark elves, light elves. Those elves, as described, were man-sized or even taller. And in Beowulf, they mention elves being strong and dangerous, like warriors.
Like Will Ferrell in Elf.
Exactly.
Strong, dangerous, tall.
I've read that Tolkien felt that the idea of tiny elves was due to, initially, French reworkings of myths. It spread to the Victorians, who relegated all fantastic things to children's stories. And the elves of the Prose Edda became more like the elves that work for Santa. Tolkien hated that stuff. Now, elves seem to be a big mashup of fairy and elf. People use this word interchangeably. It's a tangled history, one I have neither the experience nor the time to go into too deeply because it's complicated. There's so much cross-pollination with all these different cultures and the different myths, and they get changed, and woof.
The Grimm brothers are here to help because I'm sure these stories will explain everything. So let's jump in.
So this story is actually three stories in one.
All right, let's start with the first one, Die Wichtelmänner Nummer 1.
It begins with a pie shoemaker. He's a good guy, he works hard, but he's poor, no fault of his own.
Well, that was a curious note right out of the gate. He didn't gamble or anything. It was just a bad shoe market out there, I guess. But this speaks to what is somewhat surprising in these stories for a modern audience, I think, in these fairy tales. What the characters do or don't do often doesn't matter. They're at the mercy of fate. We're used to seeing character arcs, you know, people learning things, taking action. Forces in the universe might conspire against them or push them around, but they find the tools they need to survive. And in these stories, it's often just a series of things happening to people, and they don't display any growth or ingenuity of any kind. The shoemaker is in a bad economy. He only has leather enough to make one last pair of shoes, as we heard. Now, he's a pious man, so I suppose you could say that he takes action in that regard. That evening, he cut out the shoes, which he planned to work on the next morning. And since he had a clear conscience, he commended himself to God and went to bed and fell asleep. So commending himself to God. And then in the morning, he also says his prayers before coming out to the workbench to finish those shoes that he'd laid out the leather for. So in terms of taking action, he's pious.
But when he gets there, he finds that the shoes have already been made.
Yes, and as we heard at the top, they are perfect, not a stitch out of place.
A customer comes in, sees these amazing shoes, and offers to pay double the normal price for these things. With that money, the shoemaker can buy enough leather for two pairs of shoes.
I wonder if this will develop into a pattern.
He cuts the leather to get it ready to work in the morning, but guess what? Both shoes have been made. He's able to sell both pairs of shoes, gets enough money to buy materials for four pairs of shoes. He preps the materials before he goes to bed, and I'm sure at this point, he's kind of counting on those shoes getting made.
Yeah.
But they are. They're made. And again, he finds buyers. This continues, and the shoemaker becomes successful.
I do like how this tale sort of gives you a roadmap for success. in terms of building a business. Obviously, you're not going to have magical elves in the real world, but it is sort of backdoor teaching you about margins. He was able to make enough on that first pair of shoes to be able to reinvest in the business and grow it slowly, step by step. And this story is kind of helping you out to learn that.
Yeah. He's taking the money and he's reinvesting it in his business. He's not taking it out and buying himself like a big cigar.
Exactly.
One night, not long before Christmas, see, it is significant to this time of year, the shoemaker and his wife decided to stay up late to see who's actually been doing all this work. And I think that it is significant that it's right before Christmas because that is the time of year where people are more generous, thinking of others.
This story is a lot more of a holiday religious connotation to it. If you're pious, the angels will come help you out. I think the elves sort of fill that role a little bit. Yeah. But I was unimpressed that they didn't wait out after that first night of the shoe being made.
Yeah.
You know, I like the really conversational way the husband brings it up. What would you think about staying up tonight? You know, if we do that, we might be able to see who's been lending us such a helping hand. He didn't say, you know, but everything else in there is verbatim. Oh, do you think we should figure this out, maybe? Somebody's doing a home invasion and messing with our stuff. By the way, maybe a bit of a stretch, but an elf that did some similar things for a family, Frankenstein's monster. Remember?
Right.
They were really broke, and he was a mysterious benefactor. Anyway, there are some clothes hanging up in the corner of the room, suggesting this shoemaker might also be a hoarder. It's enough of a mess for the couple to hide behind.
When it was midnight, the two cute little naked elves scampered into the room, sat down at the shoemaker's workbench, took all the work that had been cut out, and began to stitch, sew, and hammer so skillfully and nimbly with their little fingers that the amazed shoemaker could not take his eyes off of them. Indeed, they did not stop until everything was done and the shoes were left standing on the workbench. Then they quickly ran away. They're naked!
Mm-hmm.
Is this to make them more animal-like? Or to show that they are free from care, or maybe because it's going to play into the story later.
It's certainly not to make things more erotic, because I must have read this passage 20 times, and I felt nothing. Kept trying.
The wife suggests that they make something for the elves to show their gratitude, and the shoemaker agrees. They decide, well, since they're naked, let's make them some clothes. They must be cold.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it is a way to civilize them, is what I was thinking as well.
I mean, you think about what somebody might need when you're getting them a gift. She probably thought, well, we'll give them gift certificates to Starbucks. Oh, wait, they don't let you in if you're naked. We're going to have to take care of that bit first.
Between them, they make the two elves shirts, coats, jackets, trousers, stockings, and little shoes.
At midnight, the elves came scampering into the room and wanted to get right down to work. But they found the nice little clothes instead of the cut-out leather. At first they were puzzled, but then they were tremendously pleased. They put the clothes on quickly, smoothed them down, and said, "Now we look so fine and dandy, no more need to work and be so handy." Then they skipped, danced, and jumped over chairs and benches. Finally, they danced right out the door and were never seen again. But the shoemaker continued to be prosperous until the end of his life and succeeded in all his endeavors.
Wow.
That's the end of the first part.
Yeah. It's odd that they just left afterwards. They were still helping out during this whole time. And then once they got some clothes, they left. Were they enslaved in some way? Was it that God sent them to do this task? And they had to do it. You know, they were naked, so they couldn't go anywhere else, I guess. And once they got clothes, they were free of that bond, and they can do whatever they wanted to do.
Right.
Which, I guess, is that what's going on? It's also weird, too, because when the shoemaker and his wife do a nice thing for the elves, then they lose their helpers.
But they're still prosperous.
Yes.
I mean, yes, maybe God didn't let the elves have clothes, or perhaps you're meant to ally with the elves and go, look, they put somebody else's needs before their own. They were naked the whole time, but they made sure that this guy was helped out first, and then there was a reward for them because they put other people first. Maybe.
Okay.
But I felt like it was continuing to hint at business issues. In fact, this and Rumpelstiltskin have to do with other people doing your work for you and what that means when you benefit from the labor of others. Will the bill come due for that? How do you handle profiting from the work of others? And here, this company owner decides to pay it back. And it works because they'd set up the business well enough that he didn't actually need them anymore. So it's a pretty fair deal. He continues, you know, he succeeded in all his endeavors.
Yeah.
It might have been a different message if the business had crumbled after, but it didn't.
No.
And I thought it might even harken back to your discussion of billionaires on Harrison Bergeron, when you were saying, why don't you want to pay taxes? Didn't all that benefit you at the beginning? Mm-hmm. The roads, the city, you know, the things that a working infrastructure provides. And so I really thought this speaks to that a little bit.
Yeah.
You have to be grateful for the things that you didn't even ask for that helped you set up your stuff and pay it back in some way if you can. So I felt like there was an economic message in this one.
All right. Yeah, I could see that. You've turned me around. I'm not confused anymore.
Good.
And that gets us into the second tale, Elves Part 2. It has a poor servant girl who works really hard. One day she finds a note. Since she can't read, she gives it to her employers and they tell her what it says.
It was an invitation from the elves who asked the girl to be godmother for one of their children at a christening. The maiden didn't know what to do, but her employers finally persuaded her that it would not be wise to refuse the invitation, and she accepted.
How random is that?
Are they screwing with her? I mean, do they just have fun with her illiteracy? It was just a, you know, phone bill or something? And no, I guess not.
Not at all. Three elves show up and lead the servant girl to a hollow mountain. This leads to a fairy land where everything is tiny and beautiful. After she does her duties as godmother, what they don't really go into, they don't specify what those duties are, she's ready to go home. But the elves persuade her to stay for 3 days.
As with comedy, everything in these fairy tales works in threes. Even this tale has three sections to it. Anyway, she hangs out for 3 days.
The little folk did all they could to please her. Finally, when she insisted it was time for her to leave, they filled her pockets with gold and led her back out the mountain. When she arrived home, she wanted to resume her work, so she took the broom that was standing in the corner and began sweeping. At that moment, some strange people came out of the house and asked her who she was and what she was doing there. Indeed, she had not been gone for 3 days, as she had thought, but she had spent 7 years in the mountains with the little folk. In the meantime, her former employers had died.
That's the end of that.
Whoa! So she got a lot of gold, but obviously not enough to stop sweeping. So she lost 7 years out of her life?
Yeah.
Is this a bad ending or is this a good ending? I'm not sure. Is the gold worth the 7 years of your life? I'm not sure. Does she still need a job? Is it enough gold that she doesn't have to do it?
Right. Maybe she just came back to sweeping out of habit and didn't really think, oh, I could take this gold and invest it. Again, she didn't make many decisions. Things just happened to her. I wonder if this family that had her show up ever talked to the shoemaker. Like, you had a great home invasion. Those elves came in and did all your work for you. We just had some out-of-time chicks sweeping our floor. But if this tells you anything, I think actually what it is trust your gut. Don't be overly polite. You know, when you're younger, you can just go along with people because you don't have the will to tell them you're uncomfortable with something.
Sure.
Like, she wants to go home, but they're like, no, stay for 3 days. And that's what gets her into so much trouble because she's trying to be polite. So I feel like maybe there's a message here.
You know, right.
Do what you think is right. Don't.
That was her mistake, not the whole idea of accepting an invitation to be a godmother for some elf.
No, that was polite, but she should have split after she saw the kid.
Our last of the elf stories, I'm not going to paraphrase this one because it's too short, so just take it away, Heather.
The elves had stolen a mother's child from the cradle and had replaced the baby with a changeling who had a fat head and glaring eyes and would do nothing but eat and drink. In her distress, the mother went to her neighbor and asked for advice. The neighbor told her to carry the changeling into the kitchen, put him down on the hearth, start a fire, and boil water in 2 eggshells. That would make the changeling laugh, and when he laughed, he would lose his power. The woman did everything the neighbor said, and when she put the eggshells filled with water on the fire, the blockhead said,
"Now I'm as old as the Westerwald, and in all my life I've never seen eggshells cooked as these have been."
And the changeling began to laugh. As soon as he laughed, a bunch of elves appeared. They had brought the right child with them and put him down on the hearth and took the changeling away.
The end.
That just seems to be a tutorial on dealing with changelings.
And we've talked about changelings before. It's what the cuckoo bird does in nature. You steal the nest, put your own baby there. That baby takes the affection of the parents. But why is it the laughing that works? Maybe it's because it forces the baby to reveal its intelligence. Because if you put some eggshells out with water in them, a normal human baby is going to look at that like anything else. It's just shapes.
Yeah, it's not going to make sense to it.
This baby saw it and it made him laugh. And then I guess that was the trick?
I guess so.
Well, that's how you deal with changelings, folks.
Practical advice. We are now jumping into Rumpelstiltskin.
There's one thing we haven't brought up yet and aren't going to bring up much, but just wanted to reference it, the Arne Thompson Uther Index, which catalogs specific themes found in folktales.
Mm-hmm.
This was something that was created in the early 20th century. It's been updated ever since. I can link out to inform on it in the show notes if you're interested. It was originally created by the Finnish folklorist Antti Aarne in 1910. This story is ATU number 500, the name of the helper, and we'll see what that means.
Once upon a time, there was a miller who was poor, but he had a beautiful daughter. Now it happened that he was talking with the king one time, and in order to make himself seem important, he said to the king, "I have a daughter who can spin straw into gold."
In some other versions, he's actually just talking about his daughter's golden hair and gets misunderstood. But I like where the Grimms landed with this. He's a poor guy. How did he happen to be hanging out with the king?
I don't know. I was wondering that myself.
And in order to make himself seem important, he said to the king, "I have a daughter who can spin straw into gold." I love that setup. He wrote a check his ass can't cash. Even though he doesn't himself have to pay for this. Well, I guess he does with the lost daughter, but
sure, yeah.
I think all the nonsense that follows might just be supporting why this particular thing is a bad idea. Don't boast if you can't back it up, because other people might pay for that.
Yeah. The king obviously doesn't really buy any of this. So he says, "Hey, bring her to my castle tomorrow and we'll see."
"I'll put her to the test," he says. It seems from this that maybe he's skeptical, but the way things go down once you're in the castle, he was definitely hoping that it was all real, because he's got some rooms set up to test this out. Is the kingdom having money problems?
They always do.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
The next day, the king locks the girl in a room full of straw and a spinning wheel and tells her, "If you can't make this straw into gold, you're going to die." Whoa, that escalated really quickly.
Yeah, it did.
Because I thought that the guy was making kind of a friendly boast, you know, just like, "My kid's awesome." But no, now he's going to murder her if she can't deliver.
But he's a poor miller, and the king and this, you don't mingle with those guys because they don't care about you.
They don't.
Your life is meaningless to them.
Once locked in the room, she cries because, of course, she can't spin straw into gold. And as she cries, a little man comes in.
Now, I remember him being a horribly disfigured Hop Frog Tyrion type. I think it might have been because of the book of this that I had, which I've been trying to track down and I can't find it, but it's something from the late 60s or 70s. Something like an off-brand little golden book that I read this in. And in that, Rumpelstiltskin was very ugly. But all it says here is a little man entered. So he's just a little guy, not that freaky. Otherwise, it would have been noted. On that Once Upon a Time show, it was Robert Carlyle playing Rumpelstiltskin. If you search the name Rumpelstiltskin, Robert Carlyle comes up now, and he looks quite scary. So
yeah, sure.
I'm not the only one who thought that, I guess.
This little man asks her why she's crying, and she explains. And he says, "I can do it for you if you give me something." She offers him up a necklace, and he agrees.
She had a necklace on when she went into captivity, thankfully.
This dude rocks the straw and turns it into gold, working the whole night through. In the morning, the king comes in. He's blown away. But instead of being cool, he decides to lock her in a bigger room with more straw.
Yep, like I said, he's got a whole other room prepared just in case this works. A superlative room. By the way, why does he leave her in all night? Why doesn't he watch her to see how she does this? It's like he's a James Bond villain, you know?
Yeah.
"I'm gonna leave you in here to die, Bond. In the meantime, I'm gonna go do something else."
That night, the little dude shows up again and says he will do it for her, but not for free. She offers up a ring that she has, and he agrees to that.
Mm-hmm.
The next morning, the king wants more gold, drops her in an even bigger room with even more straw, and tells her that if she does it again this time, he's going to marry her.
To himself, he thought, "Even though she's just a miller's daughter, I'll never find a richer woman anywhere in the world." Again, I feel like all of these have some kind of labor theme in them or capitalism theme. The king realizes this woman is a producer, which is more valuable than an inheritance.
Yeah.
This is something the world eventually comes around to. Oh, wait, titles don't always come with money because these people aren't that bright and they blow it and they don't produce anything. So it's more important to engage with the mercantile class because they cater to a market and can generate more money. I really feel like that's lurking in the recesses of
this
story.
It does feel that way, yeah. Little dude shows up, but this time she doesn't have anything to offer this guy. "Then promise me your first child when you become queen." Was it scary?
It got to me, yeah.
She doesn't have much of a choice here, so she agrees, and spinning he goes. The king is true to his word, and the miller's daughter and he are married. A year later, she has a baby, and guess who shows up? It's a little dude.
I kind of lost a little sympathy for her here because it says, after a year she gave birth to a beautiful child, the little man had disappeared from her mind.
Oh, yeah.
How did she forget about Rumpelstiltskin? Just because she doesn't know his name?
Well, he's just not important to her anymore. She has what she wants, and so she doesn't care, even though it was his actions that gave her everything.
I'd also remember, I promised my firstborn to somebody. I just feel like I'd remember that.
Especially a supernatural little dude.
Yeah.
She tries to buy him off because she's wealthy now, and he's not going to take it. He says he prefers something living. And this feels like maybe it's a reference to maybe a pagan sacrifice of old religions. You know, that you've got a baby and then you could do it to the gods. She cries her eyes out. And he takes pity on her and he says, okay, look, I'm going to give you a chance. If you can guess my name in 3 days' time, I will let you keep your baby.
Okay.
This makes me think of in ancient times when one would invoke the true name of a god or spirit, you would have power over it.
And this is that tale type that I was talking about. Knowing a name gives you power to succeed over the adversarial force.
The next day, he shows up and she guesses a bunch of names and none of them are right.
Casper, Melchior, Baltzer, none of them are working.
The second day, she asks around if anybody knows any weird names, and she tries all of them out, but none of them are right.
Is your name Ribs of Beef, or Mutton Chops, or Laced Leg?
On the third day, a messenger shows up and says he was climbing a high mountain when he found a cottage where a crazy little dude was singing and dancing around a fire. He was hopping on one leg and screeching,
today I'll brew, tomorrow I'll break. Soon I'll have the queen's namesake. Oh, how hard it is to play my game, for Rumpelstiltskin is my name!
You can imagine how happy the queen was when she heard the name. And as soon as the little man entered and asked,
what's my name, your highness?
She responded first by guessing, is your name Kunz?
No.
Is your name Heinz?
No.
Can your name be Rumpelstiltskin?
The devil told you! The devil told you!
The little man screamed, and he stamped so ferociously with his right foot that his leg went deep into the ground, up to his waist. Then he grabbed the other foot angrily with both hands and ripped himself in two.
Oh my goodness, that was not in the story I read when I was a kid, and that is amazing!
He gets his leg stuck in the ground and then tries to grab his other foot and then he rips himself in half.
I feel like he did it on purpose, just like, I screwed this one up again, rip.
Wow.
But yeah, I guess maybe it was an accident. Regardless, it's a fatality.
Also, she does this coy little fake out for some reason. She guesses two fake names even though she knows it's Rumpelstiltskin. Why does she do that?
Rule of three is she wants the answer to land with impact, and that's the way to do it. Two setups and then bam, punchline. It's pretty great that she toys around with him, but he was toying with her.
He gave her a chance. That was his fault. He should have just taken that baby because that was his kid.
Yeah.
But he took pity on her and being a nice guy, finished last, dude.
Well, he couldn't resist the action. It's another, you know, economic right, thing. He's like, wait a minute. He should have put, you know, okay, I'll let you do this, but I get two babies. You know, he should have rolled it up.
He didn't roll anything up, though. He was only going to get, if she didn't do this, he was only going to get what he was already going to get. So from an economic standpoint, this guy, he's an idiot.
If they're supposed to guess your name, don't go outside and dance around and say your name.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Lessons learned here. Also, I thought it was weird that he says, tonight I brew, tomorrow I bake. And that sounds like some cannibalism. You know, he's going to eat that baby. That's what he's going to bake.
The baby is definitely on the menu. He's got a date with Dracula's brides. He knows what to bring.
Rumpelstiltskin gets shafted because he did what was asked of him. He was on time and on budget, and she just rips him off. And she's not clever. She didn't trick him. He took pity on her. She didn't even find him. Some messenger just happened to know about it.
Like the servants being clumsy and inadvertently solving everything in Snow White, this messenger, also not clever, just stumbled across Rumpelstiltskin singing the song out in the open. Obviously, Rumpelstiltskin shouldn't have been doing that, but Mr. Mitzelplick was more clever on the Super Friends. Speaking of the Super Friends, that was a villain, and if you said his name, he would disappear, right?
No. You had to get him to say his name backwards.
Yes, you had to get him to say his name backwards. That's what it is. Superman would have to figure out a really clever way to get him to do it inadvertently. So, again, we have that more modern sense of the hero has to work something out in order for it to be a tale that we're used to. This thing where stuff just happens to people is really alien to us. But the tail type, still present even in a Super Friends episode. So it's sort of an eternal thing, knowing the true name of an adversary.
Oh, yeah. And there's, like you said, a ton of versions of the story. Rictin Rictan in France, Tom Tit Tot in Britain, Gillytrut in Iceland, and even in America, there is Rappy Tail-Tail Skin in Louisiana, and in African-American folklore, there is Tambu Toe.
In the earliest Grimm version, it's Rumpenstunchen. The name changed over time. I don't know if they were trying to make it easier to pronounce or less German, or I'm not sure. Huh. There are also stories like The Rival Kempers, Duffy and the Devil, Old Bet. These all have not just the knowing of the name, but other elements of this story. It seems like such a random assortment of things that happen. The straw into the gold, the fact that the Miller's hanging out with the king. But these show up again and again in these other tales. Even the fact that the messenger just happens to see the person out dancing around singing their own name shows up in a bunch of these stories.
And the other versions, the Miller's daughter, she's like a really good person and a hard worker. Mm-hmm. But in this story, we don't get any sense of her personality at all. In other versions, she's the one that actually tracks down Rumpelstiltskin. So she's out there in the woods, searching around, doing some research, hitting the libraries, doing all that stuff. But in this one, she doesn't do anything. She's just hanging out.
In the earliest version of it that you can find in Zeip's anthology, when it's called Rumpenstunchen, that is from a letter that Jacob Grimm wrote when he was just sharing the bare bones of these. And the funny thing is, the king's not even a character. She's trying to do something else, and she accidentally keeps spinning gold, and this makes her really sad. I don't know why. Should make her happy. And then Rumpelstiltskin comes along, or Rumpenstunchen, and says, "Ah, don't worry about that. You know what? A prince is going to come along soon and marry you, and everything will be okay. But for that information, I want your firstborn child." I mean, it just like cuts right to the chase.
Whoa.
So I think the Grimms were like, what a wasted opportunity. Yeah. This spinning into gold, we got to use that. So they built it out into a... an opening.
Yeah.
Which I think is cool.
I think it's really cool. Some good elf stories. Good. Rumpelstiltskin isn't really an elf. He's just a little guy. Maybe he's an elf. I don't know. It's ambiguous.
He is a supernatural creature of the woods who probably likes to eat children. So this is something that we're going to have to contend with
in
next week's story as well. Hansel and Gretel, which is a really famous one. I do have, like I say, this Jack Zipes really scholarly version of this, but I think I'm going to watch the Jeremy Renner movie. To get all of that straight for the next episode. I'm sure it really follows it well.
And I'm sure that's probably the more accurate telling of the tale.
I'm going to watch that. I'm not going to read it. And then that'll get me prepared for next week. Great. I want to thank Heather for reading for us.
Oh my God, she's so good.
Good Rumpelstiltskin.
Amazing.
One of the first things that attracted me to her was how she sang Rumpelstiltskin song. I caught her in the woods doing that. I'm going to marry this woman. I also want to thank some patrons, and I'm going to start by thanking Glenn Wolf.
I want to thank Samantha Vinci.
Kyle, thank you.
Christian Smucker, thank you.
Chase Hansel, thank you.
Gabriel Lankianu, thank you.
Richard Gates, thank you.
Ethanol Party, thank you.
Charles P. Norton, thank you so much.
And lastly, I'd like to thank Ryan Fahey.
You guys are the best. We're going to conclude our month of Grimm's Fairy Tales next week with Hansel and Gretel. Thanks for hanging in with us, and hope you enjoy your holidays. If you celebrate Christmas, it's coming up. Have a good one.
Happy holidays.
Happy Hanukkah. Happy Kwanzaa. Happy solstice. We'll be back next week. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Exclusively on Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.